Welcome to Canary in a Cornfield, a podcast from the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, where we explore how the policies that shape our food and farming systems impact our health, our communities, and our future. As most of our listeners probably know, the Harkin Institute was founded upon the retirement of longtime public servant and Iowa legend Tom Harkin in order to continue doing high-quality work on the policy issues that were important to him. In this week's episode, I wanted to focus on the many different benefits of citizen water monitoring programs. At the Central Iowa Source Water Resource Assessment presentation last summer, one of the opportunities we provided for people getting involved was signing up to do water monitoring. And we had over 50 people sign up to be connected with the Isaac Walton League. In fact, many of them probably spoke with my first guest for this episode, Heather Wilson, who is the Midwest coordinator for the Save Our Streams program for the Ikes, which is sometimes used as shorthand for Isaac Walton League. As we'll see in this episode, the Ikes program of distributing nitrate monitoring kits has a number of different benefits, including getting people more engaged, helping people learn the science related to water quality, and also producing valuable information for the annual nitrate report that the Isaac Walton League produces. In addition to these benefits, water monitoring can also be used strategically in campaigns by communities looking to clean up their water. And for this dimension, I spoke with Cole Dickerson of the Socially Responsible Agriculture Project, which is a group that does amazing work around the country. So with no further ado, let's jump in and find out what we can learn from citizen water monitoring programs. I am very excited today to be joined by Heather Wilson of the Isaac Walton League. They had an important annual report come out recently, and Iowa was heavily featured in that. So, Heather, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for giving me the opportunity.
Maybe first we could say a little bit about the Isaac Walton League. I know it's one of the biggest environmental groups in the country, but could you tell me a little bit more about what the organization does and specifically how it connects to water issues?
Absolutely. So the Isaac Walton League of America is a national conservation nonprofit. It was founded in 1922. So we've been around for over 100 years. And we were originally founded by a group of hunters and anglers who were really dissatisfied with what they were seeing in the environment that they loved so much. They were seeing, even 100 years ago, the deterioration and the changes that were leading to a less productive environment. And so this group was formed, and the mission stays the same. It's to conserve, restore, and promote the sustainable use of our natural resources. And that includes soil, air, woods, waters, and wildlife. And the league has grown to include about 40,000 members across 200 plus chapters. And those are spread all across the country, but we have extra pockets of activity. We have a lot of members in the Mid-Atlantic and the Midwest. Iowa actually has some of the most chapters, I think, of any state. There's about 39 chapters in Iowa, over 6,000 members. So if you're in Iowa and you might be familiar with an Isaac Walton League chapter nearby.
I definitely encounter the Ikes a lot of places in Iowa. And it seems like Isaac Walton League, maybe because of that fishing and hunting background, sometimes environmental groups are associated with being on the left of the political spectrum, but it feels to me like Isaac Walton League has a different role in the environment. Does that seem right to you, where it's across the political spectrum?
I would definitely agree. That's one of the things that makes Isaac Walton League a little bit unique, is that the focus is something that I think a lot of people can get behind. Conservation with an eye for outdoor recreation is a really appealing message to people from all parts of the political spectrum.
And tell me a little bit about your role. We've run into each other at conferences on things related to clean water, and I know you're doing a ton of stuff.
So my role is the Midwest Save Our Streams coordinator. And in that role, I serve as part of the clean water team. And we are focused primarily on community science, or it's also called citizen science, participatory science. It has many names. But essentially, this is when we're inviting people from all different backgrounds, scientific or not, mostly not, to do science with us. And in our case, that means water quality monitoring. So this is basically our way to make water monitoring something accessible and inviting and easy for people to participate in. So in my role as the Save Our Streams coordinator, I serve volunteers throughout the Midwest and honestly, increasingly beyond the Midwest in some of our citizen science programming. Save Our Streams is one of the programs. We do chemical and biological monitoring of waterways, but also we have our Salt Watch and our Nitrate Watch program, which I know we'll be talking about today.
For sure. We're definitely very familiar here in Iowa with the importance of water quality monitoring. And it seems like Isaac Walton League has multiple components. You might advocate for monitoring on a statewide level. And there's some fundraising going on for the Water Monitoring Network in Iowa. And I'll make sure to post a link for that. But then also the citizen science component you mentioned. Could you say a little bit more about why that citizen science component and people getting out there is important?
There are so many reasons. I mean, personally, my background is in environmental education. So I see it with a certain lens and others might see it with a different lens. And they're both valid. But my favorite part of citizen science is that it's a teaching moment. It's very hands-on and it's taking something abstract like water quality and making it tangible, visceral, and hard to ignore. And so it's a great educational opportunity for someone who might have heard about water quality issues. Maybe you're living in central Iowa and you can't stop hearing about nitrate in the news and you want to get your hands on some data. This is making that easy for you. Also, you mentioned the water quality monitoring is such an important piece of the puzzle as far as environmental quality as a whole is concerned. How can we fix something if we don't know what the problem is? And in Iowa, there have been a chipping away of some of the water quality monitoring resources that exist. And for some people, this is a supplement to the monitoring that's being done by agencies. And it's more specific. It's allowing you to monitor the waterways that are relevant to you personally, whether that's your tap water or the waterway, the stream that goes through your neighborhood or the lake that you like to visit with your family. So it's taking water quality monitoring and making it accessible and really relevant to people.
All of the different types of monitoring are important because there are those continuous sensors that are very specific and measure changes really quickly, but they're only at a few key locations across the state. But citizen science gives you the ability to go further upstream and get more fine-grained about which rivers and streams that you're looking at. So that's really valuable. You mentioned the Nitrate Watch program. So why don't you tell me a little bit more about why that has been an emphasis and why you do an annual report about the topic?
Certainly. Yeah. So Nitrate Watch is, of all the programs that the Isaac Walton League's Clean Water Team supports, this is our youngest. We're just about 3 years old, but it's been a big 3 years. We've grown considerably. So launched in 2023, and the goal of the Nitrate Watch program has always been to mobilize volunteers to measure nitrate pollution in the waterways that they care for. And this can be surface water, rivers, lakes, and streams, but it's also drinking water, whether from a private groundwater well or from a public water utility. And we accomplish this by providing free test kits to volunteers. It includes a bottle of nitrate test strips and then the instructions to use those test strips. They're very simple to use. And then really importantly, instructions to report the data. We use the Clean Water Hub database for all of our volunteer monitoring activities. It's super simple to use and really easy to navigate. We help people get started all the time and people find it really useful. But even if you're not monitoring, if you're just a person who's curious about water quality, you don't need a login. You can just go to the Clean Water Hub at cleanwaterhub.org and see what data is being reported. And we consider this really important because not only do we want people to know about their own waterway and their own water quality, we want them to share that so that we can all learn collectively where are we at with the scope and the scale of this pollution problem across communities, states, and even the country.
Do you have any favorite stories that you've heard from participants when they go out and monitor?
It's a good question. I think some of the best stories, maybe not the most exciting, people who go out and they expect to find really high levels and they're like, my test strips aren't working, but the nitrate levels are so low and it's good for you. That's a great thing to be finding out. Nitrate actually can be elusive because unlike some pollutants, it's used up in the environment. It might be used up by algae to form an algae bloom, or it might be used up by plants to grow. I've been ankle deep in a stream where I can literally see the cows standing in the water. They're doing things in that water too. And there's algae of abundance. And I test the water and it's very low. There's also stories of folks who measure their drinking water and they're surprised that it's not very low. The first time when I was living in Des Moines, I measured my drinking water and it was 5 milligrams per liter, which is well below the drinking water standard, but it was still much higher than I expected. And I think a lot of people have that realization when they test their drinking water. Sometimes even if they have a reverse osmosis system that's used to remove excess nitrate from drinking water. They'll test it and they'll be surprised that it's still in an uncomfortable range for them.
Oh, really?
It can only remove so much, these technologies.
And are there any stories of people doing water monitoring and then using that data in their community in ways that have resulted in interesting changes?
So a lot of our volunteers use Nitrate Watch as a jumping off point. They want to gather data, but then they might be the kind of person who wants to use that data. And we completely endorse that and empower them. And sometimes that means posting their data on social media and getting more attention for it that way. Sometimes it means reaching out to their legislators and saying, hey, I tested my water. What's up? Maybe a little bit better worded than that. But people will reach out to their legislators and they'll share their data and a story about why they find water monitoring to be important and maybe even provide some ideas about what we should all be doing as a state to address this issue. So there's certainly examples of people using their Nitrate Watch findings to tell that story to people who can hopefully make a difference.
Yeah, there's a self-selecting audience of people I interact with, but I definitely see a lot on social media of people posting about, oh, I just measured the Raccoon River at this point today, and this is what I found. Or people said, at the creek behind my farm, I just found that the levels are high, so I wonder what my neighbors are up to. So it's definitely something that in Iowa, I've seen quite a few examples of people using those test kits, as you say, as a starting point to look into different topics in more detail.
You're like a detective. I've got this evidence. What does it mean? We've also had several volunteers be in touch with the media. Sometimes it's because the media will reach out to our program and we'll have a conversation and then I'll connect them with the volunteer. And those testimonials are really great too, when they can take a reporter to a stream and they can show them what they're seeing with their testers as well. All really great examples of getting more attention and reaching more people with this important story and problem.
And I guess the most immediate thing that prompted me to reach out to you was the report that came out recently. And I know you do an annual report about nitrates. And this one I saw on the news mentioned a couple times. So could you tell me a little bit more about the report and what some of the key findings were?
So the report that we released, I think we released it in early February. This is our third annual Nitrate Watch report, and it's basically summarizing the participation and the results that were obtained by volunteers through Nitrate Watch and also our other citizen science programs that involve nitrate pollution in 2025. So we're summarizing how many folks received kits, how many folks reported data, and what did that data tell us? And it was a huge year last year for Nitrate Watch in terms of kit requests, but also in terms of data reported. So in 2025, we sent over 2,200 kits to volunteers across the country. Those are kits that folks will reach out and request them from us, and they're sent via the mail. So we sent over 2,200 kits in 2025. In 2024, we sent less than half of them. We sent over 1,000 kits. Which is still a lot of test kits, especially for a program that is as young as ours. We were very happy with those numbers in 2024. But in 2025, we were blown away by the amount of test kits requested by volunteers. And many of those kits came from islands. So in years past, we would send maybe 200, 300 kits to islands. And last year, we sent over 1,400 kits to islands. Huge explosion in kit requests is really indicative a growth in interest and concern about nitrate pollution in Iowa. And I'll also point out that many of those requests were from first-time volunteers, people who hadn't found our program before. They were finding us for the first time last year, and they were wanting to get involved. And in terms of Iowa, we have really good geographic coverage of the state, both in terms of kit requests and data reported. And I want to attribute some of the success to the work of our staff and our partner organizations for recruiting and educating those volunteers. But it's really undeniable that there's just been an increase in awareness across the state in general about nitrate pollution in Iowa. Some high profile events like the lawn watering ban in central Iowa, the release of the Central Iowa Source Water Research Assessment. It was really hard to ignore if you were an Iowan last year, especially in central Iowa, but really across the state. So more and more people were finding this program. And it really gives me hope because I think that means that people are not just hearing about it, but they're wanting to do something. And Nitrate Watch, for many people, is that something.
Something I've heard a lot recently, people will say, Iowa has some serious issues that you're dealing with, but there's also an interesting energy of people doing work and being leaders and engaging with the issue. So I'm glad you also see that as a sign of hope. Were there trends beyond Iowa, where you saw higher patterns of activation and surrounding states, or other big picture trends that you saw from looking at the national data?
Definitely. So Iowa will, I think, remain our leader as far as participation. It's taken a strong lead. But other states like Minnesota and Wisconsin, we've also been working hard to increase engagement in those states. And we've seen an uptick in kit requests and participation with some great work by partner organizations, too, to support those volunteers more regionally. We are a national organization and we have staff in a few select places, but it's great when we can connect with organizations in the places that we are interested in. And we are interested in the upper Midwest, Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, because these are places where there's a known pollution problem of nitrate, whether it's in surface water or in groundwater. And people are, again, becoming increasingly aware because of the news that they're hearing about, the reports that are coming out in these states about the sources of pollution. And so those are states where we're seeing an uptick in participation and data reporting.
Another thing I saw in the report was you specifically mentioned 5 milligrams per liter nitrate nitrogen. The EPA limit is 10, but people are concerned with health even levels above 5, which is something we've talked about on this podcast. But I didn't know if you had anything you wanted to say about why you decided to mention that in the report.
Yeah. So you mentioned 10 milligrams per liter of nitrate nitrogen. That's the EPA's drinking water standard. If you get your water from a public water utility, that is the standard that they are held to. Private users are on their own as far as testing and mitigation goes. But as you mentioned, adverse health effects have been associated with drinking water with levels of nitrate that's lower than 10 milligrams per liter, especially with prolonged exposure. That level where it becomes problematic to human health is still a matter of debate, and it should be, because there's a lot of factors at play, a lot of different health issues associated with nitrate pollution in our drinking water. 5 milligrams per liter is a conservative choice, I think, if we're choosing a new threshold, quote unquote, to measure our drinking water against. And this is by no means a new standard or anything. We haven't created a new standard. That's something that is above my pay grade. But there are certain research articles, scientific papers that have pointed to adverse health effects at 5 milligrams per liter or higher. So that's why we use it in our report. But I'll also say there are different papers that point to 4 or 3 milligrams per liter or even lower as having some effect on increased incidence of health effects, which I should mention the health effects are numerous, but they include cancers like bladder cancer, colorectal cancer, ovarian cancer, also increased incidence of thyroid disease, neural tube birth defects, preterm births. The list goes on, and cancer, for one, is very difficult to pinpoint. This is the one thing that caused your cancer, but nitrate pollution has definitely been connected as a contributing factor to these various health conditions. So as far as where our drinking water readings reported by our volunteers lie, the national number, over 34.8% of drinking water readings submitted by our volunteers were 5 milligrams per liter or greater last year. So 34.8%, that's over a third. In Iowa, that number is a little bit higher. If we just look at Iowa drinking water values that were submitted by our volunteers, 42.3% of those readings were 5 milligrams per liter or greater last year. This is higher than the number we saw last year, and that could be indicative of more people are testing their drinking water, which they certainly are, and that is great and very helpful. Could also be a sign that there was more nitrate in our drinking water last year, which in some cases, that is just demonstrably true, like with our water utilities having to do so much extra work to remove the excess nitrate before it reaches customers.
Yeah, it's been an interesting year in Des Moines where, of course, as you mentioned, we had the lawn watering ban last summer, but then there have been reports from Des Moines Water Works of high readings even over the winter, which is rare.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's concerning, and I'm glad you guys are encouraging citizens to help contribute to keeping track of it. Also, the report mentions the economic impacts of nitrate pollution. Could you say a little bit more about what you found there?
Yes. So when we talk about the impacts of nitrate pollution, we're typically dividing it into different categories. We talk about the environmental impact, the human health impact. And then if that's not enough, the economic impact usually is enough to convince most people that this is worth paying attention to.
And especially legislators.
Yes. And different people come to different issues with different lenses. And my philosophy is whatever makes sense, whatever works for you, as long as we're all working towards the same goal. So the economic impact comes from such a variety of sources because nitrate pollution shows up in so many different ways in our lives. The environmental impact of creating algae blooms and dead zones and fish kills, all of those things carry a price tag. The mitigation, the restoration, the lost value in the fish that were killed, that has a price tag. The health side, it's expensive to get sick in America. It's also expensive to remove nitrate from our drinking water. So treatment technology, the medical costs, the lost productivity, all of that carries a price tag. But then other industries are also affected, like the fishing industry, when we have water that doesn't support aquatic life down in the Gulf, for example. Our property values on waterfront property, when the water is no longer a desirable place to be, the value is affected. Outdoor recreation is a big one. When waterways are not safe to be in or they're just unsightly, outdoor recreation suffers. And there was actually a 2015 paper that took all of those different factors and more, even more factors than I mentioned, just related to nitrate pollution. And they summarized the economic impact of nitrate pollution in the United States annually. And it was estimated to be $210 billion per year in the U.S. to address all of these side effects of the high nitrate that's entering our environment.
That's huge and something that obviously should be taken into account in policymaking.
Yeah.
This is all really wonderful. So maybe you could tell listeners more if they want to get involved with the Isaac Walton League, what are some different things that they can do to connect?
Certainly. If you want to learn more about the Isaac Walton League in general, you can head to our website, which is IWLA.org. That's Isaac Walton League of America. On that website, you'll find so much information about what the league is up to beyond just our clean water program, but you can definitely find ways to get involved with water monitoring as well. So from IWLA.org, you can search Nitrate Watch. If you want to cut right to the chase, you can also just type in nitratewatch.org and you'll find us. On that website, you can find more information about what Nitrate Watch is. You can find resources like our FAQs, which talk about the nitrate pollution problem in general, but also about the program, how to participate. And importantly, you'll find a kit request link. If you want to request a test kit, fill out that form and we'll send those in the mail. They are free as supplies allow, which supplies do allow, thankfully, because we are still receiving record-breaking kit requests. Adam, you mentioned that Des Moines and other parts of Iowa are experiencing high nitrate in their water right now, and people are taking notice and they are flocking to this program. Once again, we've sent over 700 kits to Iowans already this year. That's over half of what we sent last year. Another record-breaking year, I think, might be on the horizon. So go ahead and request your kit if you want to get involved. Remember, you can measure nitrate in surface water as well as drinking water. And there's 25 strips in each kit, so you can do a little bit of everything. I'm also happy to be a resource. If you have questions, definitely feel free to reach out. My email is on the Isaac Walton League's website. It's hwilson@iwla.org.
Great. And when people do this, are they connected to a community of other people who are also doing monitoring? Is it something that people just do on their own, or what does it look like?
It's choose your own adventure. It's however you want to participate. A lot of folks will participate independently and they just report results wherever they're interested in monitoring. But there are numerous partners in Iowa who, if you reach out, would love to connect with you and provide a little bit more support. Some of those partners, the Iowa CCI is a statewide organization, Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement. They've become a robust partner in the past couple years and they do a lot to enhance the education and the advocacy components of what we're doing at a local level, which is great. If you're in Southwest Iowa, the Nishnabotna Water Defenders would be happy to connect with you and support you locally. In Eastern Iowa, we've got partners with Scott County Watersheds. They're participating in Nitrate Watch and Salt Watch, another program of ours. And then for education and just general support, the Iowa Environmental Council is a great place to go for all things environment, water quality. They work with nitrate quite a bit. Those would be some places that you could go for more of that personalized regional support. Whenever I talk about nitrate in drinking water, I always like to point out the private well testing that is available if you are an Iowan. It's a free resource through the Department of Natural Resources, and it's underutilized, but if that's your source of drinking water, you are encouraged to get it tested once a year, if not more. And this is a resource that will do that for free. You take a sample and you send it to a lab, and they'll test more than nitrate. It's arsenic, E. coli, and maybe a few other contaminants. We definitely encourage folks on wells to use Nitrate Watch as supplemental to that, but I never want to dissuade people from getting the best of the best lab quality information for their drinking water. So if you are on a private well, I encourage you to check out that resource.
Good reminder. And I know that's a pretty serious concern in Iowa is the private wells. Thank you so much, Heather. I really appreciate the great work that you guys are doing. And I see Nitrate Watch and Isaac Walton League doing excellent work. Really appreciate that. And thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
I am very excited to be joined by our second guest this week, Cole Dickerson from SFRAP, the Socially Responsible Agriculture Project, which is a group that I am a huge fan of. Cole, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's really great to be here, Adam. Thanks for having me on.
We're going to talk about the Water Rangers Monitoring Program, but since SFRAP is such a great group, I thought maybe you could tell us about SFRAP and what the organization does.
We work with communities nationwide to protect public health, environmental quality, and local economies from the harmful impacts of industrial livestock facilities or factory farms. We also call them CAFOs, concentrated animal feed operation. We do a lot of different stuff. Sometimes a community reaches out directly to us because they learned that a factory farm is proposed in their area. They're concerned. They don't know where to start, and we can help them figure that out. Identify public comment opportunities, identify opportunities really to protect their community, which is the number one priority for a lot of people we work with. Sometimes we work with partners on local, state, or federal policy and regulation. And then we do a bunch of other stuff too. Our Water Rangers program that I work on, we specifically teach people how to monitor water quality, specifically those communities that are impacted by industrial livestock facilities. We have a couple regions we focus on where there are really high concentrations of industrial livestock facilities. Some of those are the Midwest, the West Coast, and the Southeast. But really, there are a few states that we haven't worked in.
And so I just interviewed Heather from Isaac Walton League, and they have a nitrate monitoring program that they send out kits for citizens. And that is really focused on citizen science and educating people. And one thing that jumped out to me that you said is that a lot of the water monitoring was connected to the overall mission of SRAP. So could you say a little bit more about how the Water Rangers program works and how it connects to the bigger picture of what SRAP does?
Yeah. First of all, I know Heather and follow Nitrate Watch and Isaac Walton League. They are a really great program, and it's cool to be working alongside them in this really important work. Our Water Rangers program, we teach communities how to monitor water quality, specifically communities that are impacted directly by factory farm water pollution. And this looks like a lot of different things. Traditionally, we set up trainings with a community that reaches out to us. We do it virtually, and that training goes into what the risks are when there is a facility in your area that is confining thousands of animals and how that can impact water. And then how you can take action, how a community actually has a lot of power to sample that water and understand themselves where there are pollution risks in the community and what they can do with that data. So that's how we start. And then we move into more specific training with the community about developing a water monitoring plan for their area. And that's where we do our really great work. We are the only volunteer monitoring program that focuses specifically on factory farms. Really great experience on our team. The director of the Water Rangers program, Lynn Henning, she lives within a few miles of 12 CAFOs. And historically, these facilities started popping up more and more in the late 90s and early 2000s. She's been facing this really significant problem in her community for over 30 years and started a really significant water monitoring group there. They've identified thousands of violations on the facilities. They shut down one facility in the area. So we have Lynn on our staff. She's a force. And I mention that because we're able to identify leverage points for each community we work with and help guide them to figure out the opportunities for action that will have the biggest impact in protecting their community ultimately.
And so it seems like citizens monitoring the water has a lot of different benefits. One is it gives people an opportunity for action, educates people, and gives them more hands-on experience of understanding what's happening. And then what SRAP does specifically is a really cool additional dimension to that, where it's being used to get specific information about particular locations that might fit into bigger political conversations or community conversations. I think it's really neat the way that you do that. I was wondering if you have any stories about interesting events that occur. I would imagine if you're monitoring specific locations, there might be different reactions to that. So how does that play out when you're actually out in the field monitoring?
Yeah, I have a lot of stories. Lynn has thousands more than I do. One that I think back on often is I didn't have direct experience with CAFO's concentrated animal feeding operations before I started at SRA. I had a lot of background in agriculture, the environment, and how that interacts with water and social justice, which is all what we do. Within a few months of when I started, I got a chance to travel to Kewaunee County, Wisconsin with Lynn. We were working with some communities there. If anyone's unfamiliar with Kewaunee County in Wisconsin, they have one of the highest concentrations of dairies in a single county throughout the whole U.S. These dairies are 5,000 to 10,000 cows confined in single spaces. I think they have 17 or 18 of these giant dairies. And what I haven't mentioned yet is the problem that we see with these facilities is that they produce so much waste. A single facility like we saw in Kewaunee County can produce more waste than an entire city in a year, which people don't know. That's really crazy. Green Bay is the biggest city in that area, and one of these facilities can produce more waste than that city.
Wow.
What was wild about that experience was Lynn likes to go on what she calls CAFO tours. So we were on a CAFO tour where basically we drive around, we stay on the state roads, we drive around these facilities and get a feel for the scale and identify how close a lot of surface waterways are to these huge facilities and how at risk they are too. So I got a real education early on in my career at SRAP with how intense these situations are for the communities that deal with it. And I think that's really important to understand. So we were driving around, we were looking at these huge dairies, and it was in the fall when they are spreading manure and other waste that they produce on fields. They call that fertilizer. We know that these substances are benign. They have significant concentrations of nutrients within this waste. There are toxic chemicals they use to clean the facilities in this waste, significant pathogens in this waste, and it's untreated, spread onto the environment. When we were out there doing this CAFO tour, we were seeing this and, of course, smelling it too. They basically have these big waste lagoons that they keep their waste in, and then when they're full, when they need to put it somewhere, they'll put it in these big tanker trucks, drive it on the roads through all hours of the day, go to a field, type it out, and basically spread it. And a lot of times they're spreading way more than the land can handle. And so it either runs off into waterways or it can seep into groundwater. It was really important for me to understand how significant this is and see how they're managing this waste and how there's a huge lack of enforcement and lack of competent regulation of these facilities. We saw a few instances of water running directly into ditches, and that shouldn't be happening. So that was a rude awakening for me to understand the significance. And at that time, we were doing an in-person training with the community there, and we're able to talk with the community, understand a little bit better about what they were facing, and try and figure out the best approach moving forward. So that was eye-opening, as I said, and hopefully relays a little bit about the significance of what people face.
And you alluded to this already when you made the comparison with cities. The other thing is that sewage from cities is treated before it gets put back in the water. But as you mentioned, this is untreated. The manure just gets put directly on it. And so it's not only quantitatively bigger than cities, but it also doesn't have to go through the same process of treatment.
That's a really good point. When I learned that, and when I tell people that, the alarms go off a little bit. Like, we would never want to put human waste untreated out into the environment. That's disgusting to people, but we do that with animal waste. And as I said, the quantities of it are really jarring.
And then you mentioned the impact on communities, and a previous guest, Patty Libera, talked a little bit about those tanker trucks can be really disruptive and can be damaging to local roads. Could you summarize just some of the different ways in which this impacts local communities?
It's a real problem for the people that live there, whether it's water contamination. We see surface water contamination impacts the community economically. Sometimes there are these really harmful algal blooms. We see them often in the Midwest where there's tons of nutrients that have been loaded into these lakes and streams, and algal blooms happen and they're very toxic. And our recreational beaches have to be shut down, or sometimes fisheries are impacted. Drinking water contamination is a really big one. People want to be drinking safe water, as I do. And when that's at risk, it's a significant problem. We also see, like you mentioned, high traffic when these facilities are spreading waste. There's these big tankers going by your house all hours of the night. That can be really disruptive. There's a lot of air pollution that hasn't been very well studied, and there are potential significant risks there as well. Odors, the list goes on and on. Property can be devalued. That's a huge risk for property owners. So lots of problems and challenges that we face.
Tell me more about the community members who approach SRAP. What does it usually look like?
It looks like a number of different things. I would say most often there's a community that finds out that there's a facility being proposed in their area, or they know there's a facility in their area, but they want to learn how they can make sure that they're protected from any impacts. They reach out to our community support program. We have a help request hotline. People can call a phone number or submit a form on our website. I recommend anyone who is interested to learn more, look at our website and see some of these opportunities to get involved with us. So what happens in that case is they'll submit a help request form. Our community support program will reach out to them and set up a call and basically learn more, understand the situation, and offer some support, figure out how we can help. And then we go from there. Water Rangers gets brought in a lot of those cases after CSP initially meets with them. And if they're concerned about water, we help. We figure out how they can test water. We figure out if there are any topography areas where groundwater can be at risk really significantly, which basically just means that if water is put on a field, it runs into the groundwater much more easily than it would in other areas. We have a lot of partners that have networks, and we try and do a good amount of outreach. Let people know we exist, we're here, and people will share what we do, and we'll get people that reach out to us out of the blue and learn a little bit more. Another really important way that we engage with communities is through our pre-scheduled Water Rangers trainings. I wanted to mention this. This is a really good opportunity for people who are wanting to learn a little bit more about the risk that CAFOs pose to water. Maybe they have a group of concerned community members in their area. Maybe they don't. They can join one of our trainings that we have open to the public. We actually have a couple that are coming up. We have one on March 26th for Great Lakes states. We have one April 23rd for the whole United States. And this gives people a really good opportunity to join with no strings attached, learn a little bit more about what we do, what they can do in their community, and take action beyond that call if they want to. And so we get a lot of people that kind of just want to learn a little bit more, that are actually then really motivated by the impact that they can have and take it from there.
I will make sure to share that information. I also wanted to ask, there's different levels of precision when you're measuring nitrates or other pollutants. And I'm guessing that a community member measuring wouldn't be something that you could publish in a scientific journal. But how is that information used? The data that's actually gathered from local streams or waterways, how does that fit into the discussions that are happening in communities?
That's a really good question. And it's one that we talk at length about with communities, because there are so many different things that you can do with the data that you collect. And to be clear, the communities we work with, they own the data that they collect. We're here as a program to educate and guide communities to lead their own water monitoring projects. So I think that's an important distinction. So we help think through different scenarios. One recent scenario is we're working with a community that lives right next to a facility that houses a lot of cows. And there is a ditch that runs directly next to this facility and next to this community member's property. And the facility has had issues discharging waste directly into that ditch, which is a problem. And the community member, after training with us, was able to go out, collected some of that data, extensive pictures and videos of the issue at hand, and presented that to the state regulatory agency, who then came out, and that is still pending. But that can be a big win in its own right, to get enforcement from the state regulatory agency. So that's one thing that people can do, is use the data they collect to send to regulatory agencies, who ideally will take it into their own hands and come out, do a study, do a report, and do some sort of enforcement action, which sometimes can be a fine on the facility. Sometimes it could be mandating new equipment or ensuring that any current discharges don't happen in the future. They have to build infrastructure for that. So that can be a really popular thing that we see with community members. Other times we see people that reach out to the media, and if they aren't getting traction with the regulatory agency, then they work to get involved with journalists and other media members to spread the word in their community about what's happening and the data they're collecting. That can be really powerful to get more people on board. And ultimately, that has a huge impact. If there are more community members that are taking action, analyzing water, showing local decision makers this is really important for the community, that can have a huge impact. So we see a number of different things. Sometimes people collect data and submit it to organizations or universities for research. And we work, to be clear, we work with very simple methods to start, usually with test strips, just so communities can ease in to water monitoring. And if anyone's unfamiliar with the test strip, it's a small piece of paper that you dip in a water sample. And it changes color and you can estimate the level of a specific contaminant. Other times we work with communities and get water tests sent into a lab to get more official results. And that's a really good way to get data that can be used in a study or get data that can be sent directly to a regulatory agency. So it runs the gamut.
I was also curious if you had a good example of how this was used in a way that made an impact on the ground.
Yeah, there are a lot. And usually when someone asks me this, the first thing I say is that successes can be small. We work with communities that if they just go out and test, that can be a huge win for the community. It can show the community and decision makers in the community what's important to the community members that are actually there, and that can have a huge impact down the line. So if you get a really committed community group that goes out to test water, that really has a huge impact just in a number of ways. Just going out and doing it is a win in and of itself, I always say. There are more traditional wins that we see. We work with a community in Wisconsin that started water monitoring and got really involved in the local community. We're going to zoning board meetings. We're going to conservation district meetings and helping to have an impact by providing some of the data they collected and generally their observations living next to a few big facilities that help to get a water study done in their area and help to start a conversation that will hopefully lead to better protections there. We recently worked with a community in Missouri that saw a poultry facility proposed in their area, and they didn't even need to go out and water test. They found that there was significant concerns around the topography, concerns that would show likely groundwater contamination and significant groundwater contamination from this facility. So the regulatory agency ended up pulling that permit based on comments that our community support program and our water rangers team helped them to figure out how to put together and send in. What some bigger ones, like I mentioned, our director, Lynn Henning, she's done a lot of really good work in her community and helped to shut down a problem facility that was discharging lots of waste into local waterways. And she built a lot of trust with the Michigan regulatory agency that eventually, because they figured out they can trust Lynn, she was able to provide them with the information she was seeing and have proper oversight of that facility. There are a number. Some are small, some are big. But it's always something.
I appreciate you talking about the value of quote unquote small ones, because it seems like that's always the problem we're facing, is that to really make progress, it's going to take a lot of coordinated actions from a lot of different concerned people. And that seems to be the driving force for positive social change a lot of times.
Yeah, it definitely is.
And then I guess the flip side of that, I'm curious, do you have any stories about negative reactions from the industry, and what kind of steps do you take to minimize confrontation and make sure that everything is going smoothly?
We have multiple slides in our general presentation that say avoid confrontation. It's really important to do that. Nothing good comes from confrontation in the field. I have some stories. People on staff who are more experienced in this work have lots of stories. It's no secret that the industry uses intimidation as a prime tool to continue operating without any sort of change or enforcement. I've been out driving around areas, testing water around the facility, sometimes just driving. And sometimes you're followed by a truck that is likely from the facility. That's definitely intimidating. It's a little scary whenever that happens or someone asks us what to do when that happens. We always say, just leave the area. It's not worth trying. It's not worth then stopping when you stop to get on a test and asking you what you're doing. Nothing good comes from that. So that's the thing that we see happen most often. And we try and be honest with communities we work with that can happen. And it does happen. And it's terrible when it does. There are lots of things that you can do to ensure that you're safe and you're not going to be caught up in anything that you don't want to be caught up in. But you're right. It's an important thing to note. And it's a frustrating thing to deal with. And it happens relatively often to communities that we work with. A lot of community members will come out against a facility and then be labeled in that community as anti-agriculture, which we're not. As an organization, we're not anti-agriculture, and the people that we work with aren't either. We're anti-pollution. We should be able to live freely in our community without being afraid of water contamination and air pollution and property devaluation. So there are a lot of questionable tactics, definitely, that we face and communities face. The more people that are in the fight and the more people that you work with in a community group, the less that's an issue. Ultimately, we want to see a food system that's built on principles of equity, environmental justice, democracy, and regeneration. Mm-hmm. So that's our ultimate goal in this work. We work in a small slice of a lot of other work going on. As you can hear, it's very complex. Slice of agriculture and environment and social justice work. But that's what we're ultimately working towards.
And the people who work with you, is it a broad range of ages and demographics?
It is. And that's a big strength. I think we have people who are very experienced in this work, have a lot of experience before they worked with SRAP and dealing with CAFOs and water pollution, and bring a lot to the table because they know the reality of what these communities face because they were there. A lot of community support team members actually were originally communities that SRAP worked with and that got so involved in the work that they wanted to work at SRAP. And I think that's a huge strength of ours. One other thing that I'll mention is we have three former CAFO operators on staff. So another example of how we have this really unique experience that can help communities that are facing this. These three, Craig, Susie, and Michael, they're all poultry growers in the South Southeast, and they were caught up in really predatory contracts with integrators like Tyson and Cargill and Purdue. And they work now to help other growers that are in these contracts or prospective growers. They help to educate them and help them get out of a contract or try and convince them to not go in because it can be really harmful to operators in certain cases. That's a bit of a complex thing, but we do a lot of work on that too. So you're right to point out that we have a wide range of experiences on our staff.
So for people who want to connect to the work that you're doing, you mentioned that there's a couple trainings coming up. Is that the best way to get involved in Water Rangers?
Yeah, like I said, we have a couple water monitoring trainings coming up. March 26th for Great Lakes states, and then April 23rd for the entire U.S. These are open to the public. We'll have information on our website. If anyone wants to look up on our website, we have a Water Rangers training page that will list these trainings and how to register for them. So those are really good opportunities. If you are facing a facility that you're not sure what to do about, contact us. We have a phone number and we have a help request form that you can fill out, and we'll be in touch to help you figure out what you can do. And then finally, I want to mention a really cool new resource that we have for people who just want to learn more about CAFOs and how they impact things and all the complexities included. We just published in a story map, an ArcGIS story map, which is a really cool interactive database that has maps and images and videos and a lot of great information that talks a little bit generally about how CAFOs can pollute water and impact communities, and dive into some specifics about some newer technology we're seeing, like digesters around these facilities, which are these containers that basically let the waste that the animals produce decompose, and they collect the gas to basically be used as natural gas that can be used as fuel. There's a big conversation about it. We're seeing a lot of federal funding go to the facilities that have digesters, and that's a big problem because we've done a lot of research that shows that these facilities will grow at faster rates than facilities without digesters. And there are a lot of significant questions about if this fuel is actually climate friendly, which our position is it's not, and there's a lot of problems with it.
Yeah, we had a podcast episode with Patty Libera where she talked about digesters and that there are some operations that make more money off of not even the gas, but the carbon subsidies than they do from the actual dairy produced. It definitely sounds like a little bit of a boondoggle. From the water monitoring program, have you specifically noticed that the digesters don't necessarily help that much with the water pollution dimension of things?
Yeah, we don't do studies, so that's a little bit outside of our purview. I know that our stance is digesters concentrate the bad stuff in manure. After you collect the gas, you're left with digestate, which is basically like concentrated waste, and that's still spread out into the environment. And sometimes it can be spread at the same rate as what's being spread with a lot of water. There's no water in this digestate, so it can just concentrate a lot of the bad stuff and make problems worse.
And it incentivizes more bad stuff. Yeah,
it really does.
Really appreciate the important work that you're doing, and I'm sure I'm going to have socially responsible agriculture projects on the podcast again in the future because of all the wonderful things that you guys are working on. But thank you for joining me today, Cole. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, we'd love to be back. Thanks, Adam, for having me.
That's it for this week's episode of Canary in a Cornfield. Just a reminder, you can find the Harkin Institute on social media, which includes X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, and find our webpage at harkininstitute@drake.edu. And this podcast is also hosted by Substack Canary in a Cornfield, which will include some additional links and resources that go beyond just what's in the episode. So thank you all for tuning in, and I will be talking with you soon.